This is our last, the sixth and last of our studies in the prophecy of Jonah. And you could call it, if you wish, the self-life in the surrendered Christian. Or more personally, after convention, what? Now, I don't belong to the Christian Medical Corps, but I have a little private information, and it's this: that there is a virus that gets about at conventions which has an incubation period of several days. You'll find the temperature showing up the first day or two after you get home, liable to reach the crisis 3 or 4 days after you get back, and it's a help to know that other convention girls have detected this virus, have isolated it, know how to diagnose the problem when it happens to be your problem, and the person who was the guinea pig is our friend Jonah. I remember coming home from the first two conventions I attended at the age group of quite a number of you here this morning, coming home full of joy and elation after all that I had heard and that God had led me to do in response at a convention. I suppose I expected to be warmly welcomed by the Miller family, possibly almost even fated. I didn't want to tell Mum and Dad what had happened, that I had surrendered my life fully to Christ, that I had claimed the enabling of His Holy Spirit, and that I'd really gone the length of offering for missionary service. I didn't want to get all of that off my mind to them at once. Wasn't quite sure whether it would last. And so I thought, I'll keep this rather privately, a matter in my own heart between me and God. But I think I must have expected a real welcome with the bands out and a good deal of enthusiasm. And you know, the first thing that happened when I got home was I think I had to cut some firewood. And no one made me the subject of conversation at the table. And there were the usual chores to do. And about the second day, I was beginning to feel this wasn't half as exciting as being at a convention. Everybody sang, everybody smiled, everybody was pleased to see you, and here I was back in the humdrum of home, and nobody seemed to think I was very important after all. There was the anticlimax. The virus, the incubation period was over, the temperature had set in, and I didn't know it was a diagnosable disease. You know now, because we're going to see what happened in this test case. He was admitted to God's infirmary, he was well treated, and under the antibiotics which God administered to him, we'll find that this patient pulled through. But the whole of his case history is here spread before you for your own guidance. The question is, after convention, what? Now, you'll remember Jonah's case history was something like this, that he had his call from God to go to Nineveh, that he didn't like the idea for reasons which we've discussed in our first and second study, that God chastened him and administered to him the wounds of a friend. The ultimate came when he surrendered gladly to the will of God, filled chapter 2 with his song of praise, was recommissioned at the beginning of chapter 3, had fantastic success as an 8th century BC Billy Graham, and then the anticlimax. And this incredible fourth chapter seems to be, it's not so much as if Jonah's under a gourd, he seems to be under a permanent cloud, doesn't he? And after you've read the fourth chapter, you say, well, I wish Jonah had just left that bit out. But you see, there's going to be a fourth chapter in your experience. And if God had left this out, you wouldn't have known the meaning of after convention, what? Now here are the three headings. We've got to find the cause of this low fever. We've got to find the condition of the patient. And we've got to find the cure for the disease. Now, first of all, the cause of this low fever. And I've noted down four thoughts. First, it was due to his not getting his own way. You notice? It's linked with a relapse of a very old ailment that Jonah had suffered from previously. You'll see the symptom in the first word of chapter 4. It's the word but. And you may remember from chapter 1, verse 3, that he had this dose of butitis quite a long time before, didn't he? And here it is back again. It's a sort of undulant fever. And the but, which was there in the unsurrendered heart, here it is still in the surrendered heart. The but of the old willful Jonah somehow still seems to be lurking in the bloodstream of the man who's had the colossal success of leading thousands to Christ, to God in Nineveh. Self-will in the surrendered Christian. but in the consecrated soul. The storm which previously was outside Jonah in the waves of the sea is now inside him, and the tempest is within his own soul. And the words are very strong words, but, and the temperature built up, it displeased Jonah. It displeased him exceedingly, and he was very angry. You can see the mood of storm and resentment mounting. You can see the nurse's anxiety as she takes his pulse, reads his temperature, puts it on the chart, and it stabs its way up to the top of the chart. And she reports to the ward sister, she says, we'll have to put him under special treatment, have to get a special private ward. Well, God did exactly that. He was running a very high temperature. He was a Christian who was angry with what God was doing with him. And I would just remind you that these bad, horrible moods continue in the heart of the man and woman of God, and that at the age of 17, it's just as well to know the cause of post-convention low fever. The first cause then was due to his not getting his own way. The second cause was this. It was due to his being all wrapped up in himself. Verse 3. O Lord, take, I beseech thee, my life from me. It is better for me to die than to live. It doesn't matter about Nineveh. It doesn't matter about God. It doesn't matter about the family. But Lord, I feel bad about this. They're not taking any notice of me. I feel really bad about this, God. Before I tried to commit suicide, but God, it would be far better if you murdered me. You murder me, God. Do you know, the time when we're least fitted to be taken is the time when we pray to be taken. There are three possible reasons why Jonah was all wrapped up in himself. The first one was that he was really concerned for the glory of God in Nineveh. He had preached a certain prophetic message of doom. And Nineveh, from king to commoner, had repented and been turned to God. They had found a real and vital faith in the living God. And now Jonah is going to be confronted with people who say, but your word hasn't come true. Your promised word hasn't been fulfilled. We've put our trust in the wrong God. So that Jonah, all wrapped up in himself, could plead, as it were, a theological reason for his low fever. Secondly, he felt he'd lost face personally. After preaching and having all this public prominence, after having the notoriety that made boys and girls stop in the street and say, there he is, and hurry round the corner and get another long look as he walked down the next alley, there he goes, that's Jonah. He had to be content to sit outside the city, no one taking any notice of him, and feeling that his own mana, to use a Maori word, had gone down and down because his word was no longer to be fulfilled. Jonah's thoughts had become introverted instead of toward God and toward the glory of God. What will Nineveh say about me? Was his big concern now. He didn't care about God's salvation for Nineveh any longer. I can remember in 1941 walking to the Assembly Hall in Sydney on our way through to the New Hebrides for the first time, meeting a returned missionary from India who said, look, brother, when you get malaria, you won't worry about saving souls anymore. You don't need to get malaria to be like that. As soon as you, as a missionary, get all taken up with the fact that they brought the mail to your fellow missionary instead of to you first, or that your fellow missionary sent some mail by a carrier to the plane and forgot to ask you first, have you got any mail? And you haven't spoken to her for 36 hours. That's exactly the condition of low fever. It's the self-life in the surrendered life. Now, the third cause of this low fever was this. It was due to Jonah's loyalty to principle rather than his loyalty to God. And you'll find that, I think, in the second verse. He prayed unto the Lord and said, I pray thee, O Lord, wasn't this exactly what I said would happen when I was still in my own country? That's why I fled before unto Tarshish. I knew the kind of God you were, a God gracious, merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, who repenteth thee of the evil. He couldn't adjust his ministry to the adjustment of people being born again. He had a church full of converted people, and he was still pounding away to get them converted. And God wanted him to give them a further message. He was harping on the past. He actually threw up to God the fact that those backsliding days weren't a bad idea after all. "Didn't I tell you, God, why I fled? And can't you see now how justified I was?" And it's easy to taunt God with the barren, bleak years of our wilderness experience and say, "God, my wife and I were happier as pagans than we've ever been as Christians. She's out at the prayer meeting one night in the week. She's away at the women's guild. She's on that street stall another day. We never seem to see each other at all." And it's possible in this state of low fever to start quarreling with God and say, "The old days were better." Have you ever felt like that? I can remember it early in my Christian experience, looking a bit wistfully over my shoulder and saying, "Not too sure about this being a Christian. Those days on the way to Tarshish, they were exciting." His loyalty to principle, rather than his loyalty to God, has been a contributing factor in his low fever. And the fourth point, and it's a homely one, is this. It was due to his sheer physical and nervous exhaustion. No wonder. He'd fled. He'd had that long battle of wits with God, a running duel passing through many days. He had gone into the Mediterranean. He had drowned, or almost drowned. He'd spent 3 days in this living submarine. He'd been vomited out on dry land. He'd had to get used to seeing the light again. He'd gone off and preached under the tremendous tension that Billy Graham knows in every big campaign. And at the end, he'd got the premonition that God wasn't going to do the things that he'd promised to do. And the tremendous build-up of nervous and physical exhaustion had just overwhelmed him the way it did with Elijah after Carmel, when God said, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" And he said, "I was very jealous for you, God. Wasn't that right?" God said, "You get away back." Sheer physical and nervous exhaustion will be your lot after this convention. You can't digest 4 3-course meals a day here, not in the rooms, but here, without getting a certain amount of spiritual indigestion. And you can't have the thrill of being up there at the watch night service or helping in the open air till 12:30 or one last, yes, this morning, and being here for the prayer meeting at 7, up for your quiet time at 6, without needing, when you get back, to have 2 or 3 good nights of rest. You have them. It's a very good antidote to low fever. You've been warned. Get some early nights when you go home, and don't give the low fever bug a chance. Well, now, that's about the cause of this condition. And I want to describe now the condition of the patient. There are 3 points I've noted down here. Notice, first of all, that he was still in communion with God. He could still pray. But prayer is an odd thing. Chapter 1, when he was a backslider, he didn't pray and wouldn't pray. Chapter 2, when he was a penitent coming back to God, his whole language was the language of prayer. His hymns were in the form of prayer. His history was written in the form of prayer. And his petitions were in the form of prayer. The whole language of his soul had been set to the melody of prayer. But here's prayer in chapter 4, but it's the abuse of prayer. In chapter 1, the neglect of prayer, chapter 2, the use of prayer, and chapter 4, the abuse of prayer. It was prayer in his petulance. Prayer rattling the door of God's sanctuary and saying, "God, come on out here, I want to have something to do with you. I've got a bone to pick with you, God." And that's not prayer. I can remember when I came back from one of these conventions and a young friend of mine named George Robertson in Dunedin, who worked for Patterson and Barr Limited, the wholesale merchants, and I cooked it all up to have a special little convention at Easter time for our 2 churches, the young people. I was 18 and he was 17. And we worked it all out. We arranged the speakers. We arranged the commissariat. We had the place settled. We biked out to Evansdale Glen, a magnificent place 15 miles north of Dunedin. And then I realized I had to tell Dad about it. He was the minister. So I realized the best time to choose was when Dad had finished his preaching for the day. So I waited stealthily the moment when he took off his black suit on Sunday night and sat in front of the gas heater in the lounge and looked very relaxed, and I very cautiously came in on the beam and said, "Dad." And he looked up from his Spurgeon sermon, which he invariably read after church on Sunday night, and said, "What is it?" And I said, "Dad, some of us were thinking of having a camp, Dad." "Oh, when?" "At Easter time, Dad." "And who's going?" "York Place Hall and our own young people, Dad." "Oh, you won't be having the camp." "But," I said, "Dad, we've prayed about this. You may be very mistaken in your prayers, my son. And I learned a lesson. It's no use saying, as a brickbat or a club to God, "But God, we're praying about this." Like the old Scots elder who said in his prayer very urgently, "Lord, grant us our request, for thou knowest we are very determined." And then the second thing you need to notice about the condition of the patient was that he was theologically sound. Verse 2. And immediately his thought had turned back to that lovely textbook he had as a lad at Gath-Hepher, and he said words that he must often have learned and repeated as a lad in his little Sunday school there. "He knoweth our frame, he remembereth that we are dust. As for man, his days are as grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourisheth. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon them that fear him, and his righteousness unto children's children. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him." And the lovely confession of faith, which forms Jonah's credo in verse 2, could hardly be bettered for orthodoxy. "I fled before thee, for I knew that thou art a gracious God, merciful, slow to anger, of great kindness, and repentest thee of the evil." How we torture reason when we're in this state of low fever. How inflexibly pig-headed we get. Giving God our prayer and repeating before him our credo and willingly continuing with the virus and our high temperature. And then the third thing to notice is that he was talkative. Bad sign, isn't it? Sign of a high temperature too, isn't it? Delirium. He was talkative. Verses 2 and 3. He began explaining to God why it was good for him to be a backslider. He was proud of his disobedience. He'd worked out a whole theodicy of God's ways justifying the backslider. A whole theodicy upending the pyramid on its apex and saying, "God, how smart that is. I can justify now God's sovereignty when I remain a backslider." He's got a cunning scheme worked out here to justify remaining as a permanent patient in the infirmary. And the fourth thing to notice is, verse 3, that his logic had all gone to pieces. He put a therefore there which simply didn't follow. The premises and the conclusion don't tie together, do they? "O God, because of this I fled, therefore now, O Lord, take, I beseech thee, my life from me. It's better for me to die than to live." His logic had gone to pieces, as if God would murder anybody, let alone his servant. And yet you've heard people say, "Lord, they gave me such a doing at the Sunday school committee meeting. I thought they would give me that job, and they didn't. Lord, here's my resignation. I'm going to hand it in at the next meeting. It's better for me to die than to live. Lord, you murder me publicly, pleasantly, in a way that they'll say, 'Oh, it's a shame she handed in a resignation. We'll go and ask her to come back.'" Here's a spiritually sick man. A spiritually sick man who wants to remain sick. And there's the self-life in the life of full surrender. Well, now it'll be interesting to look at the cure, won't it? That runs from verses 6 to 11. God has an amazing variety of weapons in his treasury, and you'll remember what William Cooper said, "Deep in unfathomable mines of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will." Among those bright designs, there was the hurricane that he hurled on the ship in chapter 1, verse 4. There's the east wind which blew in chapter 4, verse 8. There was a worm of all things side by side with a whale. What an odd assortment of things God uses. A tiny, creeping, wrinkly-backed, hairy worm side by side with a colossal sea monster that could act as a suitable motel for Jonah for 3 days. And God uses these diverse instruments to work his sovereign will. Well, it so happens in this case that the cure was tied to a gourd. You'll notice in verse 6 what it says. God didn't chide Jonah for what he said. He worked a little miracle just for Jonah's sake, to be an object lesson to lead him out of his condition of low fever. The Lord God prepared a gourd. When Cyprian, in the Church of North Africa, was reading that passage one day, he said the gourd probably was the ivy plant. And there was a rustle of disapproval through the congregation. It nearly divided his parish. They said, don't you take liberties with the text. Kikuyun in Hebrew means the castor oil plant. Well, I hope it was the castor oil plant. He needed a good emetic. God made the gourd, God made the worm, and God made the wind. And then God withered the gourd. Jonah said, I'll probably never get over this, God. This gourd was just what I needed. And now you've withered it. And I'm feeling this could be sunstroke added to my low fever. I'll probably never get over this. And God took away the gourd to show Jonah that there wouldn't have been a gourd if God hadn't made it. Listen to this. This is about a gourd. And it was written by another Jonah who actually took to the high seas and then came back. The Gourd by John Newton of Olney. As once for Jonah, so the Lord, to soothe and cheer my mournful hours, prepared for me a pleasing gourd. Cool was its shade and sweet its flowers. To prize the gift was surely right, but through the folly of my heart it hid the giver from my sight, and soon my joy was turned to smart. While I admired its beauteous form, its pleasant shade and grateful fruit, the Lord, displeased, sent forth a worm, unseen, to prey upon its root. I trembled when I saw it fade, but guilt restrained the murmuring word. My folly I confessed and prayed, forgive my sin and spare my gourd. His wondrous love can ne'er be told. He heard me and relieved my pain. His word the threatening worm controlled, and bid my gourd revive again. Now, Lord, my gourd is mine no more. 'Tis thine, who only couldst it raise, the idol of my heart before. Henceforth shall flourish to thy praise. The cure, the first part of the cure, was in corrected perspectives. He had to find that God gives the gourd, and God removes the gourd. And that whatever blessing we have in our work, it's from him and not from us. And if you go back this year to a year of tremendous increase and encouragement in your Sunday school, CE, fellowship association, or your congregation, remember, it's God who's made the gourd grow. And if you go back to a year of testing, when the vehement east wind beats on your work, and you see the young people slipping out of your hand, and you say, oh God, it is better for me to die than to live. Lord, give us a call to another parish. I can't bear this any longer. Then the Lord will remind you that it's he who makes the gourd grow. It's he who withers the gourd in order that we should look at God and not at the cucumber vine. The second thing to notice about the cure is that we must here recognize the extremes of elation and depression in the life of the Christian as often being rooted in trifles. They really are. And when you get back home, it may be some ridiculous trifle that will bring the first collision with mum and dad. Actually, what will happen is something like this. You've bought some books about the quiet time, and you'll be enjoying the quiet time in your room the first morning back, and there'll be a tap on the door. Dear, why aren't you out? We need you. Why haven't you cut the lunches? And you say, oh, mother, if only she understood. She doesn't know anything about a QT. And mother, I'm having my QT. What's a QT, my dear? You've got to cut the lunches. You always have cut them. And with a heave of a sigh of resignation, as much as to say, mothers never will understand these spiritually minded daughters, you just leave the QT and go and cut the lunches. You see, it's a matter of recognizing that the extremes of elation and depression are often rooted in trifles, and you've got to get those trifles sorted out, haven't you? I like these words of John Wesley, which I picked out of his biography when I read it last year. He said, regarding trifles that got him worried and got other people worried, and particularly regarding people's criticisms about his work and about his people, this: "By the grace of God I never fret. I repine at nothing. I am discontented with nothing." To have people at my ear fretting and murmuring at everything is like tearing the flesh off my bones. I see God sitting upon his throne and ruling all things well. Well, that's a great way to go home. And if Mother taps on the door and says, you give her a good hearty response and say, "I'm sorry, Mother. I'm so sorry. I was just far away from you at the moment. Where is the bread? Where's the marmite?" Now, the third point about the cure is this: that we've got to get our eyes off the goods of circumstance and on to the God of love. Jonah preaches the first word in this dialogue of chapter 4, but it's God who preaches the last. Jonah preaches about impatience, out of petulance in prayer. He gives his credo as a kind of God. There's the gauntlet. Pick it up. Can you do anything with a man who believes as perfectly as that? Can you do anything with a man who prays as well as this? Oh, you can. What's this good about? And God, in verses 10 and 11, by the use of the emphatic Hebrew pronouns, says this. Verse 10, "Yes," said God, "you, Jonah, yes, you, were sorry for the good. But I, Jonah, yes, I," verse 11, "am sorry for Nineveh, with its 70,000 people who can't even tell their right hand from their left," that is, they're still under 2 years of age, "and for the cattle too, who are better than any lantana bush or cucumber gourd." All upset over a little cucumber plant, a castor oil flower that you had as an ornamental shrub against the dark brick wall of your home, and you're not concerned about the people over whom God's concern rules in love and in constraining mercy. For the love of God is broader than the measure of man's mind, and the heart of the eternal is most wonderfully kind. The words of Jonah, the son of Amittai, are ended. Jonah the patriot, Jonah the rebel, Jonah the penitent, Jonah the surrendered servant of God, Jonah the successful evangelist, Jonah the sick convention goer. The words are ended, but not the story. But not the story. The story is that the patient recovered. And God said to the patient after he was convalescent and sent home, "Write down for the benefit of Katoomba Convention 1959-60 your autobiography. Let's have every word of it. The bit about the weeds being wrapped about your head. That petulant prayer that you prayed. That silly business you were talking about cucumbers and gourd. Give us every word, Jonah, simply, honestly, so much that we'll know that it's a true, authentic picture of our own heart. So we can adore the great physician who ensures that while low fever may endure for a night, joy cometh in the morning. Seeing then, brethren, that we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith.
This recording is brought to you by thechristianlibrary.org.au.